This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Well, let's start getting into the yogurt shop murders, where, you know, it would have been wonderful if, you know, some of these young ladies at the time, you know, had they had some sort of training, had there been some sort of thought on their own self-defense, would it have ended that way? It's a fair question to ask and to think about when we put our young people out there in the world. I'm going to note this. We're going to have to change the front title on the first segment here.
Kind of figured.
We kind of went off topic a little bit, so... I'll send an adjustment on that one. but on this part, let's watch some of the press conference from yesterday, and we'll break it down a little bit more about what was discussed and how they came to this conclusion after 34 years. Let's watch.
Over three decades after a horrible crime took the lives of four teenage girls and changed Austin forever, our hearts have healed. They're still broken. Finally, we have an answer. I'm joined today by our city manager, T.C. Broadnax, and deputy city manager, John Fortune.
After 34 years, the Austin police have made a significant breakthrough in this case. We now have evidence linking a specific individual to this case, Robert Eugene Brashers. The only physical evidence located at that scene has been matched to him. Their commitment demonstrates the will to never give up and what it means to seek justice and to seek truth. And their work will have a ripple effect across this country when they assist with other investigations.
This case wouldn't be where it is today. There wasn't recognition of everyone, police from different agencies across the country. The days after the shop caught on fire, as you can see, it appears to be just, you know, your everyday middle America retail space in a strip mall. The girls were found tied up with their own clothing as ligatures and bindings. There was evidence of sexual assault. All four have been shot head with a .22 caliber pistol. And Amy was also shot with a .380 pistol. And then the building was set on fire before the suspect left the scene. Some of the only physical evidence that was recovered was a spent .380 shell casing that was located in the floor drain. There was one confession from a juvenile named Maurice Pierce. 8 days after the murders, Pierce was at North Cross Mall, which was down the street from the yogurt shop, and he was with his friend named Forrest Wellburn. He was carrying a .22 pistol in his waistband. He was 16 at the time, and he was arrested for the possession of the pistol and taken down to the homicide office, where he was interrogated for several hours by Detective Hector Polanco. The ballistics on the .22, to see if it would try to match it with the fragments from the murder scene, were inconclusive at best. There was never any physical evidence linking them to the yogurt shop. A landmark Supreme Court case comes out called Crawford v. Washington. It reformulated what hearsay statements can be admitted in criminal cases under the Sixth Amendment. In 2018, the unknown Y profile was resubmitted for retesting because there have been technological advancements. I inherited the case in June of 2022. I spent the first few months sort of reviewing it. But one of the first things I did was I met the group of subject matter experts on DNA and genealogy. And we sat around a round table. I don't know what made me go down that rabbit hole that morning, but I did, and I'm glad I did. What I found was that it had not been submitted into the NIBIN system in many years. NIBIN is a National Integrated Ballistic Information Network. It's kind of like CODIS for shell casings. The original ballistics report said that in all probability, the weapon used from that .380 projectile was limited to an AMT brand backup model .380 handgun that was used to kill Amy. So we kind of sat down and decided, well, what are we going to do next? How are we going to solve these cases together, assuming they are related? So they had some items that could be submitted and retested, including a sexual assault kit. We reached out to all of the labs in the country that do YSTR typing and asked if they can manually search against our unknown profile. and we got a match. The South Carolina State Lab was the only lab in the country that responded that they had a match, quote, match, to our unknown YSTR, Robert Eugene Brashers. He is a perfect 27 for 27 match to our unknown profile in Yogurt Shop. So this particular Y profile is very rare. They had never really seen it before, and their population statistics estimated that it's only 0.12% of the U.S. population. So now we're getting somewhere that, you know, we're building a case here that this is Brashers, but still 0.12%. We need to be at 100%, but we're getting there. He's starting to look better and better. It wasn't until 2018, the very sort of infancy of genetic genealogy, that these detectives, some of them who are here today, got together and collaborated. How are we going to identify this guy? And in 2018, that DNA testing confirmed that all of those unsolved up there were all from Mr. Robert Brashers. So he's good for the sexual assaults and murders throughout the 90s that he never had to stand trial for. The guy even faked his own obituary and put it in the newspaper to establish an identity. Her mom would ask her to call the dad by a different name at times. So we start researching this guy on our end. You know, how is he related to our case? So we looked into this guy a little further, ran his plate, and it showed to be a stolen car out of Georgia. It was said stolen on November 29th. During this interaction, he was also in possession of a .380 pistol. It's not necessarily unique to one individual, like autosomal STRs used in CODIS. STRs are passed down paternally. So me and my brother have the same YSTR profile, unless there's some sort of mutation. But we're trying to figure out how to get from, we're pretty sure it's him, to we know it's him. This was going to be pushing all of our chips on the table with this. This was going to be the last shot effort. One of the things we retested was Amy's fingernail clippings from the autopsy. He controlled four women alone, tied them up, and sexually assaulted one of them in 1997 in Memphis. And I'm sorry that it took 34 years for us to get here, but we're here now. And, you know, Amy's final moments on this earth were to solve this case for us because of her fighting back. Thank you.
Austin Forensic Science and Austin Police have been actively working together, sometimes daily and hourly lately, along with dozens of partner agencies, forensic laboratories, and nationally renowned subject matter experts. Thanks to the due diligence of South Carolina, we finally had the missing forensic piece, a known suspect, and his DNA reference sample. Given the totality, the consistency, and the strength of these data, I am confident in the update that we're providing to you today.
There was no physical evidence tying them to the crime. Mr. Scott confessed after an 18-hour interrogation. Mr. Springsteen confessed after a 5-hour interrogation, and both confessions implicated the other two boys. Both later recanted their confessions and said they were false and coerced. In 2009, DNA testing found biological evidence that did not match any of the four boys, and on the eve of retrial, their cases were dismissed pending further investigation by the Travis County District Attorney's Office.
Let's pause for a second.
So much time.
Because that's a big piece of this case is the false confessions.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk with Bob Mata about that in just a little bit, about false confessions and how they're brought up and how once one says those words aloud, no matter what type of pressure may be on one to say those words aloud, it's set in stone then. It's, well, you said it. And they keep going back to it, no matter what. He confessed. And we never take a closer look, or we quite often in the past don't take, and still to this day don't always take a closer look at the context to it. Well, how did he confess? What kind of confession was that? Was this someone where you locked a person in a box and tortured them for a year, and then they finally confessed while they were eating their own poop, like Richard Allen in the Delphi murders? Or was this you took some youths who had, you know, some, you know, some problems that were going on in their lives, and pressured them and threatened them and made them say that they did it. That's a fascinating one in this case, because it happened within the course of hours. I mean, we're talking like 18 hours of interrogation, wearing someone down and eventually getting these confessions and false memories. But that's a scary thing, because I think when you look at the false confessions that some of these kids gave, they almost started to believe it. They started to believe they were just not remembering things correctly, and that these officers were helping pull those memories out. And then they stated them in those interviews. After walking away, they walked back going, wait a second, I'm not sure about that. But that's a weird thing to think about. I mean, how does that hit you guys, of the idea that, do you think someone could get a false confession out of you if you were in these guys' shoes and you were accused of being there that night and you weren't and you didn't kill them, but you got a system that is just hounding you and you're that young? Young and dumb, as everybody is, and they're hounding you and pushing you the way that they did. Do you think that you could have ended up being one of them and confessing to something that you did not do?
Todd, what do you think?
Oh, I was going to wait for you to go first.
Let's go back to you. I need to think about this a little bit.
It's tough because you want to say, well, I would never confess to something that I didn't do, especially murder, right?
Mm-hmm.
Essay and all that kind of stuff. But then you watch the video of the interrogations, and we only saw bits and pieces of it. We watched it here on the show, but you could see little by little their confidence in themselves going away because of the way they were treated, because of the way the interrogation went, the questions, all that kind of stuff. And then you start to go, God, would I start thinking, hey, maybe I did do something, or maybe there's a lapse of memory here.
Mm-hmm.
Why does he know so much about something that I supposedly did and I don't? And also, I just want to throw this out there. We're brought up to respect law enforcement.
Correct.
So if a law enforcement officer is sitting there telling you that this is what happened, this is kind of what it looks like, and you're being implicated on this, it's There's a good portion of me that goes, well, why wouldn't I trust what this person's telling me? Even especially, if I don't remember it, but if this guy's telling me it, it's got to be true.
Especially back then.
Yes.
It was not the client. I mean, and people who are younger going, well, weird. I mean, it was different. They were called officer friendly, is what we called the police officers. And they came to our schools. And if you saw them on the street, they'd give you baseball cards.
Yes.
And it was, they actually understood that having good PR and having relationships with the community was important, and they shouldn't look like a military force coming in and invading your town. It does kind of tend to push people away, just saying. But it was a very different time. And so, yeah, exactly. You would be thinking, well, I should trust these people. Like, why would I not? I mean, and then, well, there are such things as false memories and or blocking things out. And I think that's kind of what they were trying to do with these kids, is tell them, well, you blocked it out. It was too traumatic. You blocked it out. So I'm going to fill in the blanks. And our brains are good at filling in blanks.
Yep.
Remember in sitcoms I'm dating myself a little bit, back in the 80s, amnesia was a thing. Yeah, remember right. that? If you hit your head.
and also soap operas, right? Everybody had amnesia in soap operas.
All these characters that would suddenly, they get whacked on the head and their entire lives, they can't remember anything. You know, and quicksand was something that we had to worry about. So we believe this crap, this absolute crap that, well, maybe I don't remember what really happened. And so they can get into your psyche and make you question yourself, especially after 18 hours. You're tired. You want to sleep. You want to eat. You probably maybe they let you go to the bathroom, but not as often as you need to. You're probably nervous as hell. Probably have like explosive diarrhea. I mean, good grief. This is not an ideal scenario to get the truth out of somebody. This is traumatic. So, of course, they're going to say what they need to say to get the fuck out of there.
And then the interrogators can check their box and say, see, I got it.
Yeah.
One of the investigators on this case, and I don't have their name in front of me, but he was known as someone that he's got the perfect batting average, 10 out of 10. He's getting the confessions out of people.
Was that Hector Polanco?
I think so. Yeah, I think it was Hector. And great, sounds lovely on paper, but if you're not, everybody has a confession to give.
Right.
That's the thing. But that was overlooked because, and I think Hector thought he was getting actual confessions.
Do you think he really thought those were confessions, or he was just going for the, you believe that?
I think he thought he was getting confessions. I think he thought his tactics were breaking these people down enough to the raw data that's coming out of them. And that must be true, because if it was, because he's using his own, you know, self as a guide. Because if I didn't do that, I wouldn't confess to it. These people, why would they confess to it if they didn't do it? And that's the thinking I think a lot of people have. Not everybody is of the same ilk or of the same strength or of the same character that they would be able to withstand that sort of mental torture and not come out saying something that is not true. Some people can. Some people are going to sit there and like, no, you're never going to get me to say it. Keep wasting your time. I'll sit here till I pass out. But even if I'm passed out, I'm not waking up and still going, yeah, I did it. Not everybody has that. Everybody's different. What they did is they took some kids and they basically beat it out of them. They didn't like physically beat them, but they mentally beat this out of them. And they would not take no for an answer. They wouldn't simply accept, maybe you just got the wrong guys. And that's a dangerous way of doing any sort of investigation. But it's the narrow-minded focus of, you know, you got to get to your goal. The public, there's the pressure. They want the answers here. And they couldn't give them to them. And honest to God, at that point in time, there was no way of figuring out who this was. Yeah. We didn't have the DNA technology. We did not have it. So unless you caught the guy and he confessed to it, there really was no way of doing it. All this is a result of technology that came about decades after the actual murders took place. So that's how we got there. Let's watch a little bit more of the press conference from yesterday. And this I should note too, this was like a 2-hour press conference. We've minimized it down to kind of the greatest hits so you can see the big portions of it.
Time has passed, but it is never too late for justice. And the families of Amy, Jennifer, Eliza, and Sarah so deserve justice.
Their courage and leadership to address this need for resources in Texas shows what can be accomplished if we are willing to break down walls and collaborate for the benefit of victims and their loved ones. In 2017, I was called into one of my first meetings as the first assistant district attorney with then Travis County District Attorney Margaret Moore. It was to meet with Bob and Pam Ayers and Sean and Angie Ayers, family of Amy Ayers. She had been tragically murdered in the yogurt shop murders, and I remembered the case well since I'd lived in Austin since 1976 and grown up in Northwest Hills near the yogurt shop. I was so incredibly honored and humbled and proud to be entrusted with an important case such as this one. The AG's Cold Case and Missing Persons Unit was created to support law enforcement agencies across the state with their unsolved homicide investigations. They have never stopped following leads, testing evidence, and trying to seek the truth. He used ligatures to tie up his victims, often their clothing. He used a firearm, most often a .380 or a .22, with gunshot wounds to the head of his victims. He sexually assaulted his victims, often young girls. And sometimes, as we've seen, he set fire to the crime scenes.
Vengeance was never it. It was always the truth. And I'm here to really talk about the police department and how involved and supportive they have been from the very beginning. 10 years ago, my mom died. 10 years ago, my mom died. I went to the cemetery on Hancock to fill out the paperwork. And the clerk behind the desk, when she looked up the location of my mom's plot, paused. And then she said, I've lived in Austin for so long. please know that your family has always been in my prayers. We have been robbed of a life with nieces and nephews and grandchildren and with sisters to grow old. This sort of mindless violence continues to steal from all of us. I don't yet know how this information is going to change my life, but what I learned about myself in the past 2 days is that my brain was split in two. One part of my brain has been screaming.
At one point, I'd given up on God, but he never gave up on me, and I am thankful for that. The world needing more Mindy Monsters. The result you see today is when you have an army of people working together to reach a common goal, not for themselves, but for the victims and their families. Thank you to all of you. She went to work. She started making phone calls to everyone that would listen, and the ones that didn't listen, she made them. She was a thorn in the side of many detectives, but she eventually gained the respect of all of them. This day, I was never sure was going to get here. This chapter will close soon, but we're just getting started. You will see.
When Sean asked me to fight for justice, I said, how far do you want me to push? And he said, as far as you can. That lit a fire in me that I had never experienced in my life. And I say this to all the other family victims out there. Keep going. You will get knocked down, but get back up with a vengeance. Do not take no when your gut is telling you to push. Do not give up. Fight for what is right. He was warned against how intense and passionate I was in order to help William help this case. He never wavered. He was willing to put all of his ego aside and do what was right for the girls. She has set the bar for cold case units and missing persons units in Texas, and together we will be forming a foundation to further advance law enforcement agencies and cold cases around the country. Open the cold case boxes, please. Put the evidence in the databases. Run the rape kits. Do not wait. Do it today. You could help ease someone's pain. We have got to do better for the victims. I would like to ask President Trump for a conversation to help fix this broken system. I am glad I was able to keep my word. I was able to help you and our family find justice. I was never going to give up.
You've created hope. The Yogurt Shop murder will always be part of Austin's history. The pain from that night and its aftermath will never go away. But with the knowledge we have now, we can share some peace. God bless Amy, Jennifer, Sarah, and Eliza. They will always be a part of our city's identity.
Well, every year the software doesn't, I'd probably pass that to DTF about how often we should be resubmitting stuff. They have made, it's been a big push by the ATF lately that software has gotten so much better just recently that I've seen. And this goes out across the country. You know, if you've got old shell casings, resubmit them to NIBIN. We are getting hits in other cases already, just from a lot. Some of the approach I took for this case was a different approach than have been taken before. My goal was to look at all the evidence. What evidence do I have and what can I do with it? As technology gets better, you know, you need to constantly reevaluate your cases and, you know, go back into the, you know, go back in the vault and find out where that evidence is. And make sure you actually still have it. and do stuff with it. I took the approach of, I'm not going to listen to the confessions. I've never listened to them. I've never read them, the transcripts. And that should be the goal of every cold case. It occurred in 1990, and it was solved in 2018.
Let's pause.
We know the gun he got stopped in.
And I think that's a big thing that's going on now, and it should give every person who's gotten away with your shit forever some pause, because, the technology has gotten pretty freaking amazing. And a lot of it, people who haven't been caught, it's not because the evidence doesn't exist. It's because it hasn't been run into the databases yet. And I hope that there is concerted efforts on the part of every department across the country to get that data into these databases, because once that happens, then things can be connected, things can be linked up, and answers can be found. I wonder if in some areas, I know in some areas they do have like volunteer groups that help with this sort of thing, because it is a daunting task. You're talking decades of material that needs to essentially be cataloged into a system that can then do its matching job. But I would encourage anyone, if you're passionate about this and want to see more cases like this and justice brought to more victims, reach out to your local departments and say, hey, can I help in any way? Because many do look for volunteers and things like this, and there's not enough people out there to do all of it. And that manpower, unfortunately, becomes the big thing, and funding, because if they're looking for volunteers, it means they have no money to pay anybody for some of it. But the satisfaction and the justice that can be brought by reexamining evidence in so many of these cold cases is stunning. I mean, look what it led to here. And that was because somebody said, rerun this. The evidence has been sitting there for quite some time, but it was finally rerun because somebody took the time to do it, because somebody remembered it and they found it. So pretty amazing what that sort of technology can do.
It's heartening. It's also very sad to see the victim's family members, but also the people involved with the investigation. This was something they were very passionate about. It was something that moved them very deeply. Obviously, the girls losing their lives and the many years that this case was cold, it touched that community. And Austin is one of those communities. It's very progressive. It's kind of a party place now. But back then, it was just another town in Texas when this all took place.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.